Good morning to everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning for the second part of our series of ESG webinars. With today's focus, it's on the S of the ESG. I'm Yvonne Koh, Managing Director with Teneo in Singapore and part of our Strategy and Communications Advisory Practice. As a global CEO advisory firm, Teneo works with business leaders around the world, including many Asia corporates, solving for the full range of business critical issues and across capabilities which include strategy and communications advisory, management consulting, risk advisory, talent advisory, and financial advisory. Now, we have seen a rising emphasis on ESG issues in recent years as customers, investors, and other stakeholders look for more transparency on corporate strategies and their impact on society. Companies are making progress in disclosing their environmental impact and governance standards, but social factors have not been given the same attention until recently. So social factors include how a company manages its relationship with the workforce, the communities in which it operates, and the geopolitical environment. So the COVID pandemic has pushed S into the spotlight by highlighting a range of problematic societal issues, and the social element of ESG issues can often be the most difficult for investors to assess. So how should CEOs consider which social issues are meaningful to the company and communities while managing complex operations, profitability, and stakeholders? Today, we will talk about how the investment community view the S pillar and its related challenges and opportunities, as well as the region's sentiment towards this pillar, with focus on countries such as China and Southeast Asia. Before we start the panel discussion, I would like you to know that there is a chat function on this platform. If you would like to ask a question to any of our panelists, please post your question in the chat function and we can direct your questions accordingly during our Q&A session towards the end. Now, without further ado, I'm delighted to introduce our esteemed panel this morning. First, we have Kathy Masui, General Partner of Empower Partners, an ESG-focused global venture capital fund. Kathy is the former Vice Chair and Chief Japan Strategist of Goldman Sachs Japan. Her groundbreaking womanomics research spurred the Japanese government to promote gender diversity, and she has advised corporations on governance and diversity best practices. Next, I'd like to introduce Paul Henley, Chairman of Teneo Asia Pacific. In addition to his role with Teneo, Paul also serves as Director of Carnegie China. Prior to joining Teneo, Paul served as the White House China Director on the National Security Council under former Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Paul also played a key role as the White House representative to the U.S. negotiating team at the Six-Party Talks nuclear negotiations with North Korea. And finally, we have Bob Herrera Lim, Managing Director, Teneo Risk Advisory. Bob has advised firms not only with overall risk assessment at the regional and country level, but also developed and helped implement market entry, divestment, and risk mitigation strategies. Bob has been covering Southeast Asia's political and business risk since 2002. Before working in the United States, Bob was a practicing lawyer in the Philippines and served in a variety of government and private sector positions. So a very warm welcome to each of you, Kathy, Paul, and Bob. Thank you for joining us this morning. And Paul, if I can turn to you first, I wanted to start by diving right into how social issues impact corporate reputation. A reactive approach often means that the reputational damage has been done, and companies are repairing reputation rather than proactively taking point on specific topics. Mm-hmm. And this can often have an impact on a company's license to operate, regulatory consequences, consumer sentiment, or investor perception. So how does the China government view the S pillar, and what should companies operating in China consider in terms of proactively managing their contribution to the social agenda?
Well, thanks very much, Yvonne. And it's a great question to kick things off. You know, my own view is, China has been in the spotlight for S, the social issues related to ESG. But for foreign companies, primarily from a risk mitigation perspective, how do they mitigate risks, especially around sort of human rights issues? But my own view is there's also a positive agenda and a positive impact that companies can have in this area. Many of the areas where they can have a positive social impact also happens to align with a lot of government priorities in China as well. You know, you mentioned the E of ESG. Of course, there's very specific public goals around peak emissions by 2030 and carbon neutral by 2060. And so it becomes very clear how to align, in a sense, with the Chinese government. But I think social issues, I believe, are becoming more prominent as well. You've got efforts in China to reduce the increasing wealth gap. You hear this in particular under this banner of common prosperity, but also improve working conditions, dealing with aging populations, you know, even addressing women's issues that have, in a sense, come to the fore in recent years. And we're seeing all of these areas emphasized just this week in the annual legislative meetings at the National People's Congress. And of course, you see these in the 14th five-year plan. And I think all of these areas offer opportunities for foreign companies, multinational companies, to demonstrate how they're contributing to having a positive impact. You know, some of the issues, as I mentioned, just to close on issues like human rights, you know, abuses with regard to minority communities like Xinjiang, you know, these issues are more difficult. They're often refuted by the Chinese government. And I think, which brings me back to my last point, which is human rights issue is one of the key areas within the ESG agenda, where I think international companies are going to need to have to take steps to mitigate risks to their company through, you know, proper due diligence and other efforts. And unfortunately, this is not an area where companies will get a lot of help from the Chinese government. In fact, in many ways, they intentionally make it difficult for foreign companies to do site visits and to do due diligence. And so I think this is an area, and we've seen, you know, we've seen examples where companies have had problems, H&M, Nike, other companies have had blowback in these areas. And so, you know, this is where China views the S pillar in sort of contradictory ways that those of companies in the West might. And that poses, I think, regulatory and reputational risks for multinational companies, and need to be aware of those and try to avoid those issues.
Thank you, Paul. And perhaps now I can turn to Bob for a perspective on Southeast Asia. Similar topic. I mean, Southeast Asia is such a diverse region and with very different political inclinations. So even though the media spotlight is not as heavily focused on the region at the moment, we are seeing S issues starting to have reputational impact. So what, in your view, what are the S issues that are trending in Southeast Asia right now, and how should companies consider as the model of mitigation or rules of engagement?
Thanks, Yvonne, and good morning to everyone. So I think there are three ideas that I'd like to bring forward. The first is this: the COVID pandemic really revealed the stresses that the unbundling of supply chains has placed on Southeast Asia, right? So because of rising labor costs in China, because of rising labor costs in traditional manufacturing destinations such as Thailand in Southeast Asia or even Singapore, we've seen supply chains spreading out. Countries such as Cambodia, Vietnam, Philippines, and most likely we will continue that trend going to Indonesia. And if you are a Western firm involved in manufacturing and your supply chains are dependent on these countries will be less transparent in how they deal with S issues, which is going to be a challenge because, you know, Thailand might have learned its lessons from having been integrated in global value chains for the better part of the last 20, 30 years, similar to China. But if you're at Cambodia or you know, large swaths of Indonesia, you're just learning the ropes. So there will be some sort of frustration for global companies that as they, the expectations that they might have in established value chains around garments, auto parts, or other manufactured goods that they were accustomed to in these traditional manufacturing destinations are not going to be the same conditions that they will find the rest of them. So that's the first one. The second one is, as obviously highlighted, how companies have had to fill in for governments in many of these countries. As the pandemic hit, people were not sure where they would get money if they were laid off. They were not sure where they would get health care. This is something that you would find, you know, would be predictable in a country such as Singapore. But if you're talking of countries such as Philippines, Indonesia, Cambodia, or Vietnam, they've had to ramp up basically with their workers to fill in for where governments have lacked, whether it was procuring vaccines. There were lots of discussions among private companies operating in these countries about getting vaccines for their workers when it wasn't clear yet how governments would implement their vaccine policy. So going forward, as you know, even though the pandemic for many parts of Southeast Asia appeared to be receding in their view, the possibility of future pandemics, of spikes, cannot be discounted. And therefore, whether you're talking of pandemics, natural disasters, etc., there will be among these firms a certain kind of expectation from their workers that, you know, governments do not fulfill all the purposes, so some of the burden might fall on companies. And then finally, I think the last one is that product quality. You know, when the pandemic hit, people started looking for PPE. And they started casting about for places all around the world, you know, because people were looking for what they needed. And I think that highlighted, one, China as a source of products, as alternatives to Western suppliers, but it also led to some speculation early on, are the Chinese products as competitive, or are they as safe? Are they as effective? And I think what's going to happen is as the supply chains to these countries, whether you're talking PPEs or other products, unbundle, the pressure to clarify regulatory standards for consumers will increase. So, you know, it will be companies in the West cannot simply assume we are Western companies and therefore we are good. People will start asking questions. Are these products good enough? Are these products good enough for us? Are the Chinese products competitive enough? So we will see this kind of, you know, social dynamic playing out. So there's a burden, a lot of the burden will fall on companies because of these dynamics, that, you know, there will be sort of a privatization of the S part of the requirement. And since governments, that's the final point, since governments are going to be sort of uneven all across the place because there is no central regulatory country in Southeast Asia, the compliance with expectations in home countries or with home regulators or with banks or investors from the home countries of these companies are going to be a lot to manage for companies because they will be operating in countries as advanced as Singapore and just with upcoming ones such as Cambodia, Myanmar, you know, Myanmar is a big problem, or Vietnam.
Hmm. Yes, that's true because Southeast Asia is so diverse and like you said, the pressure is located in market. And as we turn to Kathy, just very curious to find out about the investor perspective on S, because compared to the E and the G agenda, the S pillar in ESG is less tangible and the regulation is not as mature or not as developed. So how do investors view the S pillar and what are the specific social issues that are gaining currency with investors today?
Well, thank you for having me, and it's really a pleasure to be with you all here today. To answer your question, Yvonne, I think, first of all, my former career at Goldman Sachs was as a research analyst, and our global research team were really pretty early in looking at this ESG framework of companies globally. And it was very clear that while environment and governance, the E and the G parts, were quite prominent, largely because, well, you know, they're easily quantifiable, like you just pointed out, relative to the S. But the issues with just focusing on the E and the G is the environment and governance aspect of ESG is really only paying heed to or focused on the impact of a company's activities, for example, on the planet or internal, right? How it's governing itself. Where the S of the ESG is actually the only part of the ESG framework that is looking at the company's impact on society, on its employees. So it's much more sort of a relationship with the outside world and other stakeholders. Is the S bucket. And I believe that compared to, say, 10 or 15 years ago when ESG was sort of really beginning to gain momentum, because S was more difficult to quantify, the E and the G pillars were quite elevated, let's say, from an investor's point of view, because they were quantifiable or more easily quantifiable, but the S was just kind of lagging behind. But clearly, with the pandemic situation emerging, all of a sudden, you know, employee well-being or issues surrounding how do you manage an enterprise through a pandemic really came to the fore, right? So the S pillar actually elevated very, very quickly over the last 2+ years. And second, to your other part of your question, from our vantage point, now we're a global venture capital fund looking at investing in startups and helping those startups integrate ESG into their core business strategies. So my vantage point may be a bit, you know, narrow, but I would say from an investor's point of view, the key items would be in the S bucket. Number one, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm based here in Tokyo. I don't think I need to explain to you how that is a real challenge in this part of particularly Asia. There has been some movements, but still a long way to go. Second, I would say is data security or data management. Of course, we're looking at a lot of technology companies. Data is core to everything that they do. Not just cybersecurity related risks, but personal, you know, data privacy issues. There's a lot of regulation building around this. And I know there's a lot of conversations happening globally, but that's another second key area. Third is supply chain issues. To Paul's point earlier, a lot of manufacturing companies in Japan with big global footprints, really seeing a heightened level of scrutiny by investors wanting to dig deep into human rights, wanting to dig deep into child labor, what kind of, you know, of course it's more related to the E, but what kind of materials, how are they sourced, and all of that. So I think that supply chain bucket is a third important one. And finally, and equally as important, I touched upon it early, is employee well-being, retention rates, particularly under this, you know, the great resignation that we're living through, is absolutely core as well. So I think those would be, off the top of my head, the four key items that are kind of must-haves when we're doing due diligence on companies.
Right. Thank you so much, Kathy. That's very helpful to know. And then let's dive into another topic, which I think would be quite interesting for a lot of companies which are based in Asia. There may be that groundswell of the global versus Asia versus local on social issues. And so there's a lot of geopolitical groundswells that happen in our region. It's within the global powers, as we know, US and China, but also within our region, within Southeast Asia, there's also a lot of groundswells. So global companies that are operating in Asia, they may have conflicting views on the social issues defined by global headquarters and the nuances on the ground. So I'm going to pose these questions to both Paul and Bob, but maybe Paul first, right? Are foreign companies which tend to be headquartered in the West getting better at managing this delicate balance? What are some examples that you've seen of foreign companies doing well, and how did it impact their business?
Well, thanks, Yvonne. It's a terrific question. Foreign companies threading the needle with regard to China has always been a challenge, and I would submit it's getting much harder. Geopolitical tensions between China and many Western countries make it very difficult and challenging to develop approaches to ESG that work both in China, but also work back in US, European capitals, where those headquarters are located. International companies operating in China have to understand China's social agenda from a Chinese perspective. It's very important. They also have to understand what the Western perspective is, so that they can, you know, figure out and maneuver how to avoid complications when operating in China. And Western companies, you know, still struggle to manage this balance, where Western and local values don't neatly align, which obviously was, you know, the premise of your question. But there's often tension. On one hand, employees and Western consumers, which want those multinational companies to take stands on social topics that perhaps go beyond the scope of their products. On the other, local governments and communities which see any action or statement as unwarranted intervention in their own domestic affairs, right? And that is particularly evident in China. And so the risk is magnified, I think, for consumer brands, because consumer brands often have very high media visibility, and they're also vulnerable, frankly, to consumer boycotts. And so companies have, you know, often had to sort of choose one side, incurring backlash from the other. So, for example, if you look at Tesla, you know, recent announcement that they're expanding their operations in Xinjiang, and you know, that goes over well in China, but doesn't go over so well in the United States. H&M and Nike take the opposite approach. They've distanced themselves from Xinjiang, and that goes over well in the US, but it doesn't go over well in China. So, you know, sometimes the risks of navigating between the two are often deemed too much, you know, relative to any potential benefit of remaining in the market. And so then you have examples like Google, where they were caught between, you know, different standards around censorship, and then they just pull out of the market completely. So there are a number of examples how companies handle it differently. I think you asked for some positive examples, and I think one that I would think of perhaps is Starbucks. You know, they're a highly visible consumer brand. They've managed to avoid a controversy around the S issues in China. They've been credited, for example, for having partnerships with local firms to try to understand, you know, the nuance of local norms. They've adapted to local culture and values in China. They recognize the value of family, for example, in Chinese culture. They've engaged the parents of their employees through what was called the Partner Family Forum. And so they've managed to kind of steer clear of big, you know, large controversies in China. And as a result, you know, they've grown from, you know, one store in 1999 to over 5,000 today. IKEA, I think, is another good positive example. They have, on one hand, distanced themselves from, you know, Xinjiang cotton, like H&M did, but they did so without incurring as much attention and consumer backlash. And so, you know, I think those are, you know, for example, both Swedish IKEA and H&M they're both Swedish companies. They're both part of this Better Cotton initiatives. They both have announced they would stop sourcing in Xinjiang. But H&M, you know, came out with a statement expressing deep concern, and then that provoked a boycott, and estimated around 75 million in losses. And so IKEA was more nuanced in its language, did not incur the same backlash as H&M. So these are very, very tricky issues, but there are other examples of positive examples of where companies have managed to thread that needle back to my opening line.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Definitely. Thank you for your examples, because we can hear the delicacy and the nuance just had so much a big role to play in such times where it's just so difficult to navigate. And to Bob, I'm going to turn the attention to Bob now. I think we hear less of these tensions in Southeast Asia. The media hasn't been highlighting it so much, but I'm sure it exists. So this tension between global companies and the region's needs and also the local differences in government inclination. So what have you observed about foreign companies' blind spots in Southeast Asia? Can you give us some examples? Oh, Bob, I think you're on mute. We may not be hearing you too. We're still not hearing you, Bob.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Perfect.
Okay, yes, thank you. Sorry about that. So, there are three things I think that any company coming into Southeast Asia will has to think about in blind spots. The first is, again, unlike China or even Thailand or Singapore, where you have established supply chains, basically a national government to take care of everything, as you go through Southeast Asia, you will find that your Thai supplier might have Cambodian suppliers, Vietnamese, or even Myanmar suppliers in Myanmar. And once you step out of, you know, the established manufacturing jurisdictions, if you want to call them that, the opacity increases. So one of the things we always flag to clients is just simply take a look at how much of the value that you get from your supplier in Thailand is actually value derived from one of these countries. That should be a, you know, a yellow flag already, because if a large part of the value comes from, let's say, not a Bangladesh, because Bangladesh is done well, but let's say a Cambodian or even an Indonesian supplier, then that's a warning already to watch out. Okay, that's the first thing where you get blindsided, because you think you're getting your product from Thailand when a large part of the value actually comes from a second supplier. The second thing that you have to watch for are what we call the unspoken biases. Now, you know, I lived in the States for 13 years, and then I moved back to Southeast Asia. Now, when you live in the States, you get used to, you know, the standards in terms of hiring people, in terms of you know, all the S things that companies watch out for. When I moved to Southeast Asia, it was surprising. It is not spoken, but you notice a lot of ageism, okay, in Southeast Asia. While women, especially those who belong to powerful families and, you know, family-owned conglomerates, populate a lot of the companies, there are sectors of the economy where there is still this dichotomy. This is the thing that women do, this is the thing that men do. And you know, if you only meet with the elites, if you only meet with people in Manila or Jakarta, you won't get that sense. But if you travel further out, you will get that. So that's sometimes a blind spot, because, you know, you will still see some hiring bulletin saying single women only, which, you know, you would never see in the United States, right? But you would get that. And sometimes that might be a supplier of yours, or that might be a subsidiary of yours, just because the local sensibilities, as you highlighted, are not aligned with global standards. And finally, I think the third one is migrant workers. Okay? Migrant workers in many parts of Southeast Asia do not have the rights of the locals. They are subjected to fees. They do not have the healthcare benefits. They're basically like the classic migrant worker who does not have a right in the host country where he or she is staying. And it's a challenge. It is an issue. It has been an issue in countries such as Malaysia. It has been an issue in countries even such as Thailand, right? You would assume that these countries, having been part of the global supply chain, would know how to deal with this. But, you know, on the lower parts of the supply chain, migrant workers are a problem. And even, you know, even a country as advanced as Malaysia, that is used to integration with Western companies, two of their top, you know, rubber glove manufacturers who supply millions of dollars of PPEs globally have run into problems. So there are still blind spots for companies, because again, if once you start looking below the top level, you will see different networks. And the challenge is, how do you even get a grasp on this? So we tell clients three things: see how much value is created by the secondary suppliers, see how much of a migrant worker labor force the company might have, and just, you know, just have a sense of the unspoken biases that might exist in a company. It's related to age, gender, socioeconomic status, education status. You will still get a fair amount of this. People will put ads saying, "We want only college graduates," when the job itself doesn't need a college graduate, right? Because college graduates are, you know, penny a pound. So those are the three things, I think.
Thanks, Bob. It does sound like there are, you know, with China and with Southeast Asia, there are very complex social issues that need to be looked into, and it's not as easy as we think. And then coming to Kathy, I have a question on the social issues. Actually, on the topic of social washing, just as I think for the E, there is a lot of consciousness now around greenwashing, knowing that there's a lot of social issues, and these social issues tend to be very human focused and quite emotionally resonating. But how does investors view social washing? And especially with your work with startups, you were talking about how you are advising them on building their business with ESG principles at the core. What are the startups doing right that big corporations can learn from so that they don't run into this issue of social washing?
Sure. So I think at the end of the day, it's for us critical that the S, as well as the rest of the framework, E and the G, are not simply compliance or box-ticking exercises. Oftentimes, even for the largest companies in the world, that is true. And ultimately, the managements of those organizations don't really believe that doing all these things, investing all this time and money, is going to yield any benefits for the company, right? For the bottom line. And so I think the challenges to how to convince, you know, those skeptics, whether they're public or private enterprises, on the benefits of integration of these principles, these values. And I know we talked earlier and you just mentioned that the S is less quantifiable versus the E and the G, but actually these days there are now, it's still relatively tougher, but there's a lot more quantification about these issues. And at the minimum, what I think investors like ourselves and others are asking companies for now is disclosure around policies. So for instance, DEI. You can say you're very diverse in your hiring practices, but do you have a DEI policy? Some companies sort of have one, but they never communicate that with the outside world, right? So I think it's really comes down to, if you're going to avoid social or so-called greenwashing, you have to convince your stakeholders, not just your shareholders and regulators, but people internal to the organization, that you live and breathe these principles, that you're walking that talk. And I believe that if we look at, I just talked about diversity. So why is DEI important? We've seen lots of evidence, empirical studies that show more diverse leadership team drives innovation. I think companies, particularly in most, a lot of companies in Asia, certainly in the West, are struggling with finding innovative, you know, products, services, marketing strategies, whatnot. And so if you don't have a diverse decision-making process in place, then that's a challenge, right? It also hinges particularly on recruitment strategies or recruitment ability of the best quality talent. Data security. This is actually more easily measured today than before. And clearly in this world of digital, you know, revolutions around us, this is a very, very important criteria for customer acquisition, for instance, right? So I think that the S, there are more measurable areas, and I believe that companies are now being asked more specific questions that they can supply answers using data, using hard data. And I think for our own experience, we've only been in operation about 10 months now since we launched our fund, but I think what's key is that this is not a static, okay, the management decides what's important, let's say in the S bucket, and go to it, people, you know, in the organization, but rather this is a dynamic feedback loop mechanism type process. You can come up with your material factors that you believe are most important, let's say in the S bucket, but you need to have this constant dialogue, right, with your stakeholders internally, stakeholders externally, to figure out to modulate and to adjust as time progresses on how you're focused on these issues, not just why you're doing these things, but what is the impact that you're having? What's the progress that you're making? What are the KPIs that you're setting? What's the timeline for that roadmap, right? And having that ongoing feedback loop is really, really a vital component, because at the end of the day, this whole ESG journey is not a sprint, but really a marathon.
Yeah, I like that point about the marathon. And it needs constant iteration. And especially having heard from Bob and Paul, knowing that the social issues are complex, it's also a very dynamic situation with the social issues. So both the framework adjustment and as well as assessing the social issues needs to be constantly iterating. Really, really helpful to know. And if we have all touched a little bit on how do we convince the businesses in terms of the S issue, and there is always weighing the social impact versus the economic returns. I think we know that social principles today should not be designed with the intention to increase profitability, you know, but however, businesses being businesses, they still need to be responsible to the business as well in the practices that they are doing. So at times when it may seem at odds, at times when the social impact may seem at odds with economic returns, that may be a significant challenge within the company. So to Bob and to Paul, the question is, you know, if companies should move from a reactive stance to a more proactive, considered approach to social issues. And if, like Bob said, the burden of social issues are going to be on the companies. What can companies really influence in China or in Southeast Asia? And maybe Bob, maybe Paul, you can start us first.
Sure. No, I think it's a good question, Yvonne. And I think it is important for companies to begin to take steps to move from a reactive stance to a proactive stance in addressing social issues, for many of the reasons that, you know, Kathy has so well articulated. It's becoming, I think, increasingly important for companies to be more proactive. Workers, consumers, government officials, and other important stakeholders are aware of ways in which the actions of companies can impact individuals in society, and in particular in China. Now, there are those issues where, as you talked about, you know, you have to be careful, or I've talked about where we have to be careful, companies have to be careful to stay out of controversy, to mitigate risk. But I think there is a real opportunity to be much more proactive and deliberate in trying to enhance positive social impact. And as Kathy said, I think it is becoming more quantifiable than it has in the past. And I think companies are recognizing the importance of, you know, addressing these issues. S&P Global Ratings, according to S&P Global Ratings, 90% of more than 2,000 studies conducted on the impact of considering ESG factors in investing reported average or above average returns. And considering social factors was said to improve the profitability of a company, as the market will tend to reward those companies that minimize their exposure to difficult, tricky social issues. So there is, you know, some data to suggest that it does help a company in terms of, you know, its own profitability. According to the MSCI 2021 Global Institutional Investor Survey, 79% of investors in the APAC region increased their ESG investments significantly or moderately given the pandemic. So we see that companies are taking, you know, a more proactive stance on these issues. In the China context, you know, common prosperity, the banner of common prosperity, and the specific areas within that, I'm not suggesting foreign companies, you know, carry the banner of common prosperity. This has been sort of a political theme. This is not new, by the way. In the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping proclaimed common prosperity was the essence of socialism. So common prosperity has been around in China for a long time. Xi Jinping is obviously pushing it now. But issues within that, that broad theme, like poverty alleviation and rural revitalization, income inequality, these are areas that I think are ripe for companies to take action and proactive contributions. Companies will be required in China, I think, to be shown to playing their part. And I think there will be increasing scrutiny in China as well over how multinationals are contributing to these efforts. Companies certainly, you know, like I said, don't necessarily want to parade around and use, you know, the party language. But at the same time, companies can't afford to ignore or disparage the agenda if they want to be successful in China. And it'll be important that they review their communications in China or internationally about, you know, expansion in China through a common prosperity lens. But I think there's a way to do it to avoid controversy. For example, if you look at poverty alleviation, for example, you know, there's opportunities for companies to engage in charitable efforts and partnerships Multinationals can consider developing programs and initiatives supporting the priorities laid out in the government's social welfare goals, along those goals. Partnering with charities, specific employment and training schemes, undertaking best practices to ensure domestic policies are in line with market standards. So there's specific ways that companies can contribute. And then the last point, I think, is I would go back to gender equality, which I mentioned at the top. You know, this is an area where China has made, unfortunately, little progress in the past 15 years. You know, China's rankings in terms of, you know, on the World Gender Inequality Index has dropped for 11 years. And so I think, you know, promoting gender equality is an area, I think, that the Chinese leadership is trying to address. We heard that through the remarks of the premier at the National People's Congress. You've got issues around pay gaps. On average, women are paid 22% less than men in China, even though, you know, women represent a larger share of graduates in higher education. They have 52% of women are higher education graduates than men. Maternity leave, childcare services, this is increasingly important because of the demographic challenges in China. And there's pressure on working mothers. 50% of women attribute the lack of gender equality to the lack of support provided by companies, which indicates a gap, I think, that needs to be addressed. And so there's very specific and concrete and proactive ways I think that companies can address some of these social issues, and I think that provides opportunities for companies in the China market.
Paul and Bob, how about for you from a Southeast Asia perspective? How can companies, or what can companies influence in Southeast Asia?
Okay, yeah, just to push on Kathy's marathon analogy, it's not only a marathon, it's a marathon within a triathlon, and they change the map every 15. That's the thing you will see in Southeast Asia. Now, I think the challenge in Southeast Asia is that the incentives for companies, to local companies especially, right, to change practices is not even. It's uneven across the board. So if you're a foreign investor coming in, whether you are an investor, whether you are somebody directly investing in the country to set up a manufacturing shop or a business, you will notice when you come in, one, the regulatory alignments are not clear. So the central bank might be very active in promoting ESG principles. Then you go to the insurance commission, and in terms of how they regulate domestic investment, the insurance commission says, you know, we're just on financial aspects. We don't care about ESG principles. So you will find one regulatory alignment to be difficult and weak within countries and across countries. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge you will face is that local attitudes as well, right? Many of these companies, especially family-owned companies, generate cash organically, generate cash domestically. And so for them, you know, the incentive to react or the market incentives are not as clear. I was in fact talking to one director about ESG in the Philippines, and he said, you know what, our directors are not convinced that it leads to some appreciable financial effect, right? Paul showed that data, but I think for them, we want to see somebody who actually, you know, had this on effect, and it's not just one anecdotal data piece. So they're sort of trying to, I think, wiggle their way out of it, but they claim that to be the challenge. So combined with this environment, how then do you, as a foreign firm, right? You know, this regulatory alignment this week, you know, this local incentives within the companies themselves are not as aligned. I think if you're a foreign investor, the way to do this, as you said, is to be proactive, but importantly, to clarify, you know, to sort of, you cannot lift the whole system, but you come in, you clarify. It's the same thing with corruption. Clarify, these are our goals. When you come into a country, these are how we work, and these are the benefits. And hopefully over time, if enough foreign investors come in with the same message, then, you know, whether if you're a company doing business with a foreign company or a Western company, then you start feeling the financial incentives, the reduced costs of transactions, all these benefits that finally show up as convincing old stodgy boards that, yes, there might be a benefit. So That I think is the big challenge, especially if you're going throughout Southeast Asia, that the financial incentives are not as clear because they get money domestically, they have their own sources of funding based on personal networks. The regulators are not as aligned, so it's a difficult lift, I would say.
Definitely, it sounds like so. We're having some really good questions coming through. It seems like our participants are very keen to have impact in the social area. So that's some really key question. The first question I'm posing to Kathy, can you please share some examples of the best qualification of social impact that you have seen? What metrics or what impact should be covered? How are these being verified, and how are companies acting on the information or the data that they have?
So I think I somewhat touched on this about DEI is a pretty obvious one in Japan's context. And we're not just talking about gender here. We're talking about, you know, non-Japanese in leadership positions or LGBTQ, not just women versus men. And I think that companies are finally waking up to this reality. And, you know, so they understand why, but the next challenge is how. So how are they going to implement greater diversity in their leadership teams? So I think it's not so difficult to quantify, obviously. And I think what's good is that in 2015, the government actually promulgated legislation which requires most organizations of decent size, not listed, but, you know, even less than 200 employees or more, now have to disclose their gender statistics. They're also strongly urged to issue some kind of targets around gender diversity. And this is really important because, as I always say, you cannot manage what you don't measure, right? What is the situation? What kind of goals are you setting for yourself? And if you have goals you set out as management, then obviously you're going to be held accountable. And obviously the market's going to be looking at your progress versus your peers. So this is kind of healthy competition at work. So I do think that that's a fairly obvious area. I think maybe less obvious areas, like I said, are supply chain issues, right? A lot of manufacturers are really being scrutinized, as you can imagine, in Japan, be it automakers or technology companies, apparel manufacturers, because a lot of this stuff is made abroad. And so how deep is your traceability? There are a lot of challenges vis-a-vis that, but I think there's a very heightened sense of awareness, let's say, is the good news, on that this is a very critical issue. And now that more and more shareholders, and again, Japanese stock market is about a third owned by foreigners, but the foreigners actually account for about two-thirds of daily turnover, so they kind of make and determine price action in the Japanese public market. That means you can't afford to ignore, right, these very direct questions related to the S bucket. So I think that's all very good, moving in the right direction. We're not where we need to be, but moving in the right direction.
There is also one question from the participant that says, engaging in the social pillar seems to be very much a challenging and very difficult to navigate pillar. So how does a company remain genuine and authentic in their pursuit of S, or social issues? And how do you think their culture come into play?
Can I take that?
It's a very, and yeah, anyone can take that. I think it's a big question.
Yeah, if I can start, because this is what we're dealing with right now with our portfolio companies, or when we do due diligence on startups trying to decide whether we're going to invest or not. Because for us, if there is not a commitment from their side to integrate ESG in, frankly, a marathon fashion, because this takes time, we can't invest in them. And we get this question a lot as to, so where do we start? How do we figure this out? But we also always try to gauge is an alignment of the mindset of the company with, you know, particularly in the social bucket, I think things like purpose of the company and the corporate culture, is it flat? Is it hierarchical? How does the decision-making actually work? How much engagement is there from the bottoms up? That those pieces, while a little bit more amorphous and hard to maybe grasp in number terms, to us is super, super critical because these are immature startup companies. They're just beginning to form an organizational structure. We are, though, later stage investing. We're not looking at, you know, seed startups. So they do have business traction. They may be looking to go public in 2 or 3 years' time. And when they go public, you know, though, those eyes of scrutiny are going to be very, very heightened. So preparing them for that is really, really important. So I think that's what at least we're observing. And I think in particular, I would say, you know, look, my kids are in their 20s and they don't really know much about ESG, but if they find out that a company where they've been buying products from are, you know, destroying the environment, or these days if they're dealing with Russia, you know, that's like, you know, they're voting with their wallets just, you know, subconsciously. Mm-hmm. If they think about that deeply, we have to think about that in terms of recruitment, in terms of sales, right? So this is directly impacting the revenue and the top and the bottom lines of companies. You can't ignore this trend, right? It's universal. So to me, if you're a company, you still don't kind of get it, that's the conversation that needs to be had.
Can I add to that, Yvonne? I think Kathy's spot on. I think what she just said is very compelling. You know, we have to make a distinction too. And I think, you know, often blur the lines. You know, ESG, the S part is about being good and being and adding value and contributing. It's not about public relations. It's about, you know, what the company's values are, what does it stand for, and how is it doing good? What kind of things is it contributing to help society, to help people? Now, It can be the case, of course, that once a company sort of works through that and determines the kind of things that it wants to do, it may be that those align with the government priorities in the country or the region that you're operating. And that's good. That's fine. But the distinction here is this is not a public relations exercise. This is really about thinking about, you know, how to make positive contributions to society as a company and just stand for that, you know, have the values that you want as a company and the principles and the way you're perceived, you know, by consumers and by others. And so, you know, you can have a positive S agenda and ESG that aligns with the government. And we've been talking in that way this morning. There are ways to do that. But I just think there is a slight distinction between, you know, advancing the S agenda and having a good public relations strategy.
Thank you, Paul. And there is one more question here. It seems to be posed to Kathy as well from an investor perspective. How can investors place more pressure on companies to lift standards for employees in Southeast Asia? So maybe it's a mix for Kathy and Bob. And what is the incentive for investors to engage on these issues, on the social issues?
Well, I think there's a critically important role that investors can play here, and that is, you know, by, let's say the company, okay, if it's a smallish company, it's really focused on its own market, let's say within Southeast Asia, and it doesn't need to raise capital globally, it doesn't frankly want to grow that much, I guess it's fine, right? It's hard to find the incentive. But presumably if it's a company that is, you know, growth oriented, wants to go global, wants to scale, which I think are pretty common for most companies, particularly in that part of the world, I'd imagine that they would be thinking about cost of capital, about their investor base, about risk mitigation, customer acquisition, market, new market strategies. To me, it's completely front and center with what they need to be concerned about as a business, full stop. So I think investors have a very important role. I can say from the Japanese context, you know, diversity it's not even a Japanese word, by the way. It's an important, you know, it's pronounced phonetically with a Japanese accent. And it was only until the Japanese government in 2013 said, you know, it was Prime Minister Abe at the time, for Abenomics growth strategy to succeed, we need womenomics. And everybody just like fell out of the chair. Like, you know, the first time ever the Japanese government had highlighted diversity as a driver of growth. So if you don't place it in that context, I think it's very difficult to convince the skeptics. But if you can do that, and then you can spell out, articulate all of the benefits that can accrue from integrating it into the core of your business, then I think you can easily translate what this means to the bottom line. And that's the financial incentive part.
Yeah, Yvonne. Yeah, I think that's right, right? It's the engagement with an external factor, right? An external factor that provides incentives. So it could be a company that, a foreign company that buys your products, a foreign investor, or even technology providers, right? So the challenge is, you know, how to use these levers and how to more spread it, to make it spread across the economy. That will be one of the challenges. Now, just pushing back, you know, like recounting history, I remember just after the 1997-98 financial crisis in Southeast Asia, I'm that old, there was this push in Southeast Asia on corporate governance. Institutes of directors were set up. People were talking about the role of independent directors because there was a recognition within companies, even local ones, that if you did not put corporate governance principles in place, you would have greater difficulty, not just complying with what were growing regulatory standards, but expectations of external companies, right? So I think, you know, that gives me a very good sense of this is how companies react. And Singapore is right now trying to take the lead on the E part, right? They are trying to do a green taxonomy. They're trying to build standards. MAS is trying to actively do that. And we need something like that for S, right? Maybe a local or a regional center for, you know, the exchange of ideas, and where not only ideas come in, but finance courses through, money courses through, and then the incentives then fall into place in the rest of Southeast Asia, because then companies start recognizing, right, whether it's because I'm selling to an IKEA or selling to a Japanese firm or selling to a US firm, there is a financial structure for me to benefit from better S or better E or better G. So I think that's the challenge, really. There are models for it. It's happened in the past. It's happening with Singapore. It happened during the financial crisis. So bringing it all together is going to be the big challenge.
And I guess in closing, I just want to pose a question to all three of our speakers. Can you share where you see more opportunities for public-private partnerships in advancing positive social outcomes in Asia?
Let me take a stab. In Japan's context, it's, for example, on, I'm going to come back to DEI because that's one of my longstanding subjects. But at the end of the day, this is truly a society-wide issue that cannot be tackled by one player alone. I call it the triad, right? We need the private sector, we need government policy, and we need society to change its mindset, right? Which includes media, unraveling gender role stereotypes, unconscious biases. Just fixing one of those, you know, pieces of the triangle isn't going to work. So I'm not sure if this is your question you're asking, but I think we've seen progress, like Japan until COVID actually had the highest female participation rate in the developed world, actually. It was higher than US, higher than Europe. Everybody's surprised by that. We have more women working in Japan than the US and Europe. Why was that? Because of what I said earlier, the government prioritizing this as a national strategy, but also the private sector stepping up, putting together or disclosing their data, and that creating healthy competition. And then the media started picking up on this term diversity. What is this? Why is this important? And I think that conversation that society at large was beginning to have was really necessary to move the agenda forward. Again, still a lot of progress needed here, but going forward.
Bob or Paul?
Sure, I think in a sense, the public-private partnership, you know, where you align with government efforts, and I think I've been talking about a lot of those in the China context, whether you're talking about narrowing the wealth gap, whether it's improving worker conditions Aging population is another, with China's aging population and falling birth rates. The Chinese government is very concerned about the country's population crisis. Women's rights, rural revitalization. I think all of these where the Chinese government, if you, for example, pay attention this week to the two sessions, listen to what the Chinese leaders are saying, read what comes out of that, read the 14th five-year plan. And I think you'll see, you know, plenty of opportunities to align with government efforts in a public, you know, private partnership way around the issues that are of concern in China and are a priority going forward, whether it's poverty alleviation, income inequality, healthy China, for example, healthy China 2030. Laying out China's long-term approach to developing a world-class healthcare system. And so addressing labor conditions. There's a lot of ways that I think companies and governments can combine and collaborate on efforts to address social issues in the ESG agenda.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you, Paul, and sorry. And I think with that, we are going to close because we are running over for the session. So in closing, I just want to thank our panelists and speakers. Thank you, Kathy, Paul, and Bob for a very, very lively chat. And to all our guests this morning, thank you for joining us for the webinar. We have the last of our ESG webinar coming up soon, so please keep a lookout for that. And get in touch with your Teneo contacts if you want to further discuss any of these topics that we've covered today. With that, I close and thank you very much. Have a good day.